everybody, Ben Starr here with you with The Positive Mind, bringing you ideas, concepts, and guests to help you lead a more positively minded life. Thanks for tuning in again today for part two of our discussion with Dr. Michael Aaron, who's here back in the studio with us, with me, with Kevin O'Donohue. And for those of you who missed yesterday's show, Dr. Aaron is a clinical sexologist and certified sex therapist. You may have read his columns in Men's Health or Psychology Today. You may have heard him on the Huffington Post Love and Sex podcast, or seen him quoted in the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, and on CNN. So, Dr. Aaron, thanks again for being back with us today.
My pleasure.
It's great to have you.
So let's get right to it. I mean, yesterday we talked a lot about sexology, which briefly is what? Tell the audience what sexology
is. Well, it's the scientific study of sexuality, and it's multidisciplinary. We approach it from a sociological, anthropological, psychological framework, and it's how sexuality plays out in culture and society.
So like monogamy would be something you would study under sexology.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. So
sexology is like the big picture of sex and society and culture.
That's right.
Sure. So let's talk about sex today and sex therapy and what you do as a sex therapist.
Sure.
People are struggling with a low desire for sex.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I read one of your blogs where you say that 20% of people are not having sex in a committed relationship after a certain number of years. Does that go up? I mean, which community, which population is 50%?
50%
of not having sex.
Which community? Well, I don't know. I think it's more related to the particular system rather than some demographic group. But I think that the number one reason that people don't have sex, and I'm going to cite some research by one of my colleagues, Peggy Kleinplatz, who's a psychology professor in Ottawa. People aren't having sex because the sex is bad.
Right.
And, people have this idea about sort of how it starts where this false idea about quantity. So oftentimes if we're focused on quality, well, we have to have a quickie tonight, I'm tired, and so on. And pretty soon you end up in this kind of rote mechanical sex that is devoid of intensity and kind of this real connection that makes sex oftentimes feel good. And it starts to feel mechanical and boring. And people start saying, you know what, I'm not really enjoying sex. And then sex starts to diminish and diminish more and diminish more, until one or both partners say, you know what, this isn't worth having anymore. And I think that's not always, you don't want to be categorical and say always this is, but oftentimes that's what happens.
Yeah, so how do you bring them back?
Well, I think, first of all, going back to this research from Dr. Kleinplatz, she interviewed a number of couples or partnered systems that described themselves as having wonderful sex. And we want to understand sort of what they do, what is their secret sauce, and deconstruct it so
that
we can help other people do the same.
Right.
First of all, what a lot of people get wrong is that sex gets worse with age or with longevity of relationship. That is completely wrong. And in fact, the median age in this study was 55. So the average person was 55 years old who said that they were having wonderful sex in a long-term committed relationship. And when we took a look at what they were doing, or when she took a look at what they were doing, we found that there were a few key things. First of all, they privileged quality over quantity.
Right.
So they scheduled it, and they planned it, and they were thinking, how is this going to be just a wonderful thing that is going to be like a peak experience for us during the week? And they may have been only having sex once or twice, but it's so good because there's just so much that they bring to the experience that it doesn't necessarily have to happen every day, and it carries over week to week.
Well, that brings me to a question about novelty. So Armand DeMille, who hosted this show for many, many years, used to be an advocate for novelty within sexual relationships.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing that he used to advise couples to do, maybe couples like Kevin described who are no longer having sex,
mm-hmm.
would be to get a hotel room together, even in the same city they lived in,
mm-hmm.
just for the novelty of being in a different environment. What do you make of the concept of novelty and sexuality?
Well, I think it's a key ingredient. There was a sexologist, sex therapist, Jack Morin, who wrote a very important book that anyone interested in this subject should read called The Erotic Mind. And he researched a number of people to find out what was involved in their peak sexual experiences. And there was a number of things, but something that was novel, that felt new, that felt transgressive was
an element.
Even with
the same person, right?
Indeed. Yeah. So there were a few key things that kind of added to the intensity of feeling like this was a great experience. Novelty was one of it. One was the sort of the transgressive element of not knowing if you're going to be exposed or caught or something. I'm not telling people to do that, but I'm just saying that there are a number of psychological elements that we have found intensify a sexual experience, and definitely doing something new, even if it's with the same person, is one of it. And there's something I wanted to add about that, because I think it's very important, because I think that you and I had talked off the show a bit about monogamy, which is a very important thing, because I think these days there's more and more information about alternatives to monogamy, and there definitely are. And there's people who are swingers, there's people who are polyamorous, there's people who are monogamish, which basically means they're generally monogamous, but they sometimes give each other a hall pass. But there's a whole slew of options for people who don't want to be monogamous. And as a result, sometimes there's this idea that monogamy is somehow antiquated. It is somehow, 1950s style stuff that really evolved, sophisticated people no longer do.
Right.
And I don't think that's true, because although I think it's a natural human response to crave sexual diversity and sexual variety, that doesn't necessarily mean that that person is non-monogamous, because other things get involved. You know, what is this person's threshold for jealousy?
That's a big one, isn't it?
What is this person's attachment style? In other words, how do they interact in a relationship? They may crave sexual variety, but they really couldn't handle it or do well with it if it's played out
in practice.
And what we found with people who are non-monogamous, polyamorous particularly, they have different psychological traits. So there's this test called the BFI, which is called the Big Five Inventory. And basically what that comes down to is that psychological research has shown that personalities can be broken down to five indivisible dimensions. And the acronym for that is OCEAN, which is O is openness to new experiences, C is conscientiousness, which basically means that you're responsible, on time, dutiful, all that. E is extroversion, or introversion would be the opposite. A is agreeableness. So, you know, how well do you work in teams? Are you a team player? Are you an empathic person? And N is neuroticism, which basically means how prone are you to negative feeling states like anxiety,
jealousy,
depression. Yes. And what we found by doing twin studies of identical twins separated at birth, and there's been numerous studies and meta-analyses, which means studies of those studies, is that about 55, maybe 60% of personality is genetic. Okay, so folks who are polyamorous, when they're studied, their O, which is openness to new experiences, is through the roof.
Right.
So how are you going to take someone who is predisposed to having low O and say, yeah, you like sexual variety, but in terms of your personality to expose yourself to a lot of variety in real life is low? How you know, that's not necessarily going to be the same psychological persona of the polyamorous individual.
So you're saying these large studies of studies found that 60% of our personality is nature and 40% is nurture?
Yeah, about anywhere from 50 to 60. So let's say 55. There are different studies show different things, but a huge chunk of it, and they did that again by looking at identical twins separated at birth. And so, you know, again, here we have this nature versus nurture. So I don't believe, and when I work with clients, I make something very clear. I said, listen, here's the thing. You can change a lot, but you're not going to do a 180. You're not all of a sudden going to go from the most introverted person in the world to the most extroverted, because we are not a blank slate. But even 10 degrees of change will have huge ripple effects and can make a significant difference in your life. So that we have to be realistic about what's possible.
What would be an example of someone changing 10 degrees?
Well, someone who would be, is someone, for example, who would
Be open to wearing women's clothes, well, no dressing up.
Well, well, someone,
I wonder, you know, you go from somebody who just would never wear sexy clothes to somebody who would.
I think
that would be an example of stretching your openness factor, wouldn't it?
I think from a more and I think from a more basic kind of angle at it is someone who before had a certain narrative that I'm this, I'm that, and all of a sudden says, well, if I try something new that I don't typically do, now I see myself in a different way. Now we're talking about some change. We're talking, and if you follow that up by saying, this is my goal to do these things, or this is the outcome I want, and you put action and behavior behind it, what happens is that there was a psychologist who said that we're meaning-making machines. And so what our brain does, it's always trying to connect the dots and be congruent. So this is an example that I use with some, you know, some of my clients are sports fans, and I'll bring it to, back to what you're saying because I think it's all interrelated. Some of them are sports fans, so I'll use a sports analogy. I'll say, you've all heard of Michael Jordan, right? Okay, yeah, right. So did you know that the greatest basketball player of all time actually did not make his ninth grade basketball team? He did not make his team in high school. So Michael Jordan, who retired as a pro 20 years later with 6 championships and so on, if you put him in a room with the best interrogation, brainwashing, mind control team that tried to convince him that he is now not a good basketball player, you wouldn't be able to do it because he has 20 years of behavior that has proven to him who he is and what his identity is, rather than if he sat in a room in the position of the thinker, the Rodin statue, and tried to do affirmations and convince himself, what would be more effective? So what I say is that you can start to change yourself by doing different things, and your mind will then start to integrate those new behaviors into a new understanding of yourself. And if we can start to kind of line up some of these changes in gradual steps, you will start to experience change. Not
so
a 180.
It's a practical application of actions speaking louder than words.
Exactly.
You're saying that the actual actions and behaviors that we take can maybe redefine how we view ourselves and how we identify.
Precisely. I mean, research backs this up. They took one study, took some folks who on a test, they took a test that showed that they were dysphoric, which means mildly depressed. Then they had them spend 2 hours practicing smiling and making small talk with pleasant cashiers and stuff like that. And then they retook the test, and they were no longer dysphoric. Their mood had lifted significantly just by acting happy. There was another study where they had folks with matchsticks hold up the edge of their lips in a smile to force themselves to smile, even if they didn't feel happy. And their mood was happier after they were forced in that pose for about an hour or so. So we have numerous studies. There's an entire field called positive psychology. A big hub of it is at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia, where they try to understand what is happiness and how do we improve it and what does it consist of. And so there's a lot of research that shows our brain, our thoughts, and our feelings change in accordance with our behaviors. Now, our behaviors can change based on changing our thoughts.
At that point, it becomes sort of a chicken and eggs scenario.
Right. That's right. It's CBT, which is change of thoughts, your behaviors. But in my experience, the behaviors are the low-hanging fruit. I'm not saying they're easy. They're easier to change than to change your feelings.
That makes a lot of sense to me.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you have like activities or things, particular exercises couples can do in order to get back? I would think sitting face to face and smiling to each other would be actually a technique that you could turn a couple that's otherwise hasn't had sex in a long time and just smiling to each other.
Yeah, I think that's good, and I'll build off of that. One technique that I use is called collaborative couples therapy. Was developed by a guy called Dan Weil out in California.
And
so basically, I model something for them, and I have them practice it. Which is, you know, people often don't really understand each other, and they have this narrative that this person that I'm with is my enemy. You know, it's like sleeping with the enemy. You have people come in and, in this system, and this is supposed to be your friend, your ally, and they're so antagonistic towards each other. They treat each other like enemies. And so part of it is that they are very defensive and misunderstand the intentions and project and so on. And so what I'll have, what I'll do is I will model a way of speaking that really gets to the heart of what a person's feeling. So, for example, maybe a person who's withdrawing, they don't have the verbiage, they don't have the words to, they're just acting on it, so they withdraw. So I'll say, you know, I really want to engage with you. I'll say this to the other partner, but it's the words I'm speaking for the other part. I say, I really want to engage with you, but when you talk to me this way, it really hurts me, and I'm so flooded with emotions that I'm overwhelmed, and I don't know how else to react but withdraw.
Right.
So when the other person hears that, they're like, okay, well, this is a human talking to me, rather than just doing these things that I don't understand, which makes me think that they're my enemy. And then I'll model that for them, and then I have them practice really talking to each other in that way. And so that's an example of where talking is a behavior, because they're talking in a different way, where they now start to integrate that and think and feel about each other in a different way.
I mean, it's kind of true. There are places, there are times when the last thing on your mind is to touch your partner. I mean, where it becomes like so repulsive that you can't get beyond that step. Mm-hmm. And I like this idea of humanizing your partner and humanizing yourself again by admitting, I like to use the one like, lately I've been feeling. To have one partner say, look, I can't even get close to you. Lately, I've been feeling X, Y, Z, and not just towards you, but towards the world, towards my life.
Well, what we're talking about here is a level of transparency that oftentimes people haven't learned, right? We talked about shame yesterday.
Yeah.
If you're besieged by shame, it's very hard to be authentic and transparent. And if then you're lacking that level of authenticity and transparency in your relationship, you're not going to be able to communicate in that way. You're going to be hidden away. And what happens is that we have this term, it's usually used in some sort of addiction lens, but acting out. But literally what acting out means is instead of talking about your feelings, you're acting on them.
Right.
So you feel a certain way. You're used to having to either fight or flight, either get angry or withdraw.
Mm-hmm.
You've learned to be maybe shamed rather than to feel that you can be authentic to another person. And so rather than learning skills that allow you to really communicate effectively, you get bogged down in dysfunctional behavioral patterns that once served you well, but no longer.
Yeah. You know, when you talk about changing behaviors to change thoughts, I'm reminded of a guest that we had on the program a few months back. She was a neurologist and an expert in brain chemistry.
Okay.
And she said that actually changing behaviors over a sustained period of time can actually carve out new neural pathways in our brains on a chemical level. So that really lends credence to what you're saying here about how changing our behaviors can actually change our thoughts, both about ourselves and the external world.
Indeed. Well, the term for that is neuroplasticity, and there's a lot of research that shows that our just like you are lifting weights, your body changes. Your muscle gets stronger and more pumped up and so on. Similarly, when you do things that stimulate your brain into new patterns of thinking and new behaviors, your brain starts to adapt. And so this is a field within neuroscience called neuroplasticity, and it's really a really evolving, interesting field.
Certainly at a young age when there's still myelination, I think is the word, happening.
Yeah.
And it's even more powerful. But you were going to say, Kevin?
Well, I was going to say, to Michael's point, nobody can do a 180. You want to give activities or things that people can do, achieve, not feel bad about if they don't achieve them. So you're not going to just automatically say you're going to go from point A, totally repressed, totally disgusted with your partner, totally disgusted with yourself, the relationship, your life, et cetera, and all of a sudden turn around and just act happy and smile. No.
No, and you know, this makes me think about an intervention that I use sometimes and I think very highly of called ACT, which stands for Acceptance and Commitment Therapy. And the reason I like it is because it combines kind of the best elements of CBT as well as mindfulness and so on. And the main premise is, first of all, you're not going to be able to fight against yourself. You're not going to be able to fight or suppress your thoughts. So, for example, if I told you, think of a pink elephant, what are you going to do? Don't think of a pink elephant. What are you going to do? You have to think of it to conceptualize what it is that you're not supposed to be thinking about. Mm. Now, let me introduce another research that kind of really pushes the topic even further. Well, researchers who were studying OCD, they wanted to understand how people who had OCD were different than a community sample without. So these are people who were really not self-diagnosed, but by a clinician were diagnosed mm-hmm. as really OCD, right. not that, oh, I like to wash my hands. No, like they were really impaired. Right. And what they found when they asked them questions, how often do you have intrusive thoughts? What kinds of intrusive thoughts are they? You know, what is your reaction? What they found was stunning, which is that folks who were not OCD had the same kinds of intrusive thoughts and oftentimes at the same frequency as the folks with OCD, except the difference is the reaction of the people with OCD. They were absolutely terrified of these thoughts. They were right. trying to suppress it. They were fighting. It made them ruminate more, mm-hmm. and it turned mm-hmm. a molehill into a mountain.
Right.
And so with ACT, one of the key ideas is of acceptance. Okay.
I see.
So if you're trying to suppress this desire to put on lipstick or whatever, you're going to create this kind of, I'm not going to say you're going to be OCD, but this kind of OCD effect of getting ruminating, becoming obsessed about it, feeling yourself filled with shame and all of that, when really the harder you try to suppress it, the more you're going to be bothered by it.
Right.
And so what we want to do is, first of all, accept who we are and where we're at. And the second part is commit to doing certain actions that make us feel more congruent. And this is the commitment part. And so another key idea there is of something called experiential avoidance. People who, this is one of the most highly correlated things that in terms of being correlated to depression and anxiety is folks who are very depressed and very anxious, they avoid new experiences or sometimes any experiences.
Is that a strategy to stay in that depression? Maybe subconsciously there's a fear of what's on the other side?
Well, you know, it's a fear of, it could be a fear of a number of things, but, you know, someone who is afraid of open spaces is afraid they're going to stay home because they're afraid of experiencing that fear. So really, I think it was Roosevelt, maybe Franklin, who said we have nothing to fear but fear itself.
Right.
So it's really the avoidance, not necessarily of that thing, but what it really comes down to is of that intense feeling state that keeps them locked into that cycle. So what we want to start to do, and this goes back to the kind of the emphasis on behavior, is we want to counter experiential avoidance with actually behaviors that are not avoidant. Now, we have to do this in a very staged, gradual process because one way of visualizing it is, let's say there's three concentric circles. And so the middle, the very center is the comfort zone. That's everything that doesn't make you anxious. You've been doing it your whole life. You wake up in the morning, take a shower, you have breakfast, no anxiety.
Things you don't even think about.
No, that's your comfort zone. The very outer layer is called the panic zone, which means you're so far outside of your comfort zone that you're so flooded with anxiety that you learn nothing, you rush back to the comfort zone, and you say, I'm never doing this again.
What are some examples for someone who could be in that outer panic zone?
Well, let's say you have a fear of
public speaking?
Yeah, let's say if you have a fear of public speaking and your first talk is on a radio show like this, you're probably going to be in the panic zone. If you have a fear of swimming or whatever, you probably shouldn't dive into the deep end of the pool. The middle circle is what's called the learning zone because what happens is instead of experientially avoiding things, which is staying in the comfort zone, we step out of the comfort zone slightly enough where we experience some gradual anxiety, mm-hmm. but not too much to overwhelm us. And we say, okay, I can do this. I feel a little anxious. It's not too bad. And if you can tolerate that, your comfort zone expands.
We know growth has to come out of some level of difficulty.
Indeed.
Right? There can be no growth from total comfort. And also on the other side of that is, you know, extreme adversity is also not conducive to growth. Right?
Indeed.
So there is that middle zone that you mentioned.
Indeed, extreme adversity is traumatizing.
How this applies to sex therapy, I mean, I can imagine there are so many scenarios where a couple are phobic of certain sex acts.
Yes.
You know, oral sex even could be like a phobia for some people, and graded, you know, activities in order to make it happen, I'm sure would be really a great relief for a lot of people.
I would extend it beyond the nuts and bolts of body parts,
No pun intended.
Yeah, pun intended, too. Maybe a fear of vulnerability, a fear of being rejected.
Yeah.
Oftentimes I see folks who, let's say the guy has some sort of and it's usually a guy, again, it's usually a guy who's the identified sex addict, or it's the guy who is the identified fetishist who's, you know, whatever. Let's say the guy says, you know, there's this fetish that's really important to me.
Right.
And I never told you about it. And maybe he has been seeking sex workers to get it, or maybe he's just been masturbating to porn. But he's been getting it somehow, but not revealing it to his partner because he's so afraid of shame. And now he's like, you know what? I've been reading enough about this. I want to integrate it into my relationship. And sometimes he's surprised where the partner is, well, it's no big deal. But what is a stumbling block for this whole time being lurking in the shadows is the fear of rejection, of being shamed, of blowback. And so this
person... Even with a partner you've been with for 10 years.
For many years. And so in many ways, how can you be fully present in your sexual life with your partner if there's so many things that you feel too afraid to bring to light?
So this is where sex therapy becomes relationship therapy.
Indeed.
And individual therapy. Right there in the room with a couple, you might be doing individual therapy while the other partner is watching this person actually go through the process of trying to verbalize something that they're terrified will get them rejected.
Yeah, sometimes that happens where maybe there's always the risk if you're kind of focusing on too much on one person, then I try to approach it as systemically as possible, but your point does stand. It's a good point.
So you said novelty, and actually I put it down as forbidden. When you introduce forbidden, something forbidden.
Taboo
into your sex life.
Yeah.
What other kinds of things can get the batteries charged again? Going to a hotel, like Ben says.
Yeah.
But
well, something that I have, an exercise that I have couples do, and I say couples, but that's just a stand-in for any partnered relationship. You know, sometimes I've had polyamorous folks, so they're kind of there's maybe three people in the system, but oftentimes they still come as a couple. So maybe they're a primary, they're primaries to each other or something. But at any rate, semantics aside, there's an exercise that I like to have people do that I think is both effective on a sex therapy front as well as just on a relational communication front, where it involves negotiation, it involves practicing transparency, and so on. And this is creating menus. And I have an exercise called red light, yellow light, green light, and I'll explain what that is. I'll say, okay, each of you make a menu. And what that menu consists of are, let's say, the green light, which is I really want to do this. Yellow light is like I'm not sure I do, but I'm willing to try. Mm-hmm. And red light is just off limits.
Right.
And then both of you compare notes and you pick one or two from the green and one or two from the yellow.
And that's a way to sort of try new things between two people and understand what everyone is comfortable with.
Yeah, and they actually have to negotiate a scene, so to speak. And what I mean by that is, okay, they have these elements, and how does that going to work here? So it requires teamwork. And like I said, a lot of times people come into couples therapy and they feel like they're each other's worst enemy. So this requires teamwork, negotiation, compromise, communication, vulnerability. It addresses a lot of these key areas.
I think it's a great way to break the ice
in
therapy to say, tell me your three. Give me your three secret desires, three things how you'd like to do our sex life differently. Everybody has it.
We're coming up on half past the hour, so we're going to take a short musical break. We are here with Dr. Michael Aaron, clinical sexologist and certified sex therapist, and we'll be back after a short musical break.
It's a position, the way that you listen, open your ears.
Thundercat with Evangelion here on WBAI. You tune into The Positive Mind. I'm Ben Starr, joined here in the studio by Kevin O'Donohue and Dr. Michael Aaron. Dr. Aaron's a clinical sexologist and certified sex therapist. Again, you may have read his columns in Men's Health or Psychology Today. You may have heard him on the Huffington Post Love and Sex podcast. And make sure to look out for his book coming out this fall, Modern Sexuality, available from Roman and Littlefield Publishers. Dr. Aaron, if you don't mind me asking, you've really dedicated your life to, you know, studying sexuality, studying how it affects people. What prompted you to really embark on this journey of becoming so well-read and so knowledgeable in this field, if you don't mind?
Yeah, sure. Well, originally when I came to New York, I'm from Pennsylvania. When I came to New York was actually to be a writer, and was writing screenplays and stories. But I noticed that everything that I was writing about was about sex and relationships and human psychology. And so I said, you know, I want to do something a little bit more meaningful that encompasses these interests that I was developing through writing. And again, I started my professional mental health career as a outreach worker in harm reduction with people who were at risk, who were intravenous drug users, street sex workers. A lot of them were transgender sex workers. And I noticed something very interesting, which was that, you know, these folks, as I said, have been very, and as one of the speakers, one of the callers yesterday noted, that a lot of transgender individuals do sex work because they're so marginalized. But then, you know, I started noticing that that is just an obvious case where someone obviously looks very different. They're trying to transition to another gender and they're being marginalized and oppressed by society. But I kind of came to the understanding that a lot of people are very oppressed and alienated and marginalized. That happens internally, that we don't really notice from an external perspective. And the more I thought about it and the more I connected it to the writing that I was doing, I kind of came to an understanding that one of the reasons I was so interested in writing about sexuality and relationships is because it's so core to our identity. And the more I researched it, the more I also realized that there was a scarcity of resources of professionals who really focused on this very vital core aspect of identity that was sort of, there was a gap.
It's amazing. And I want to ask you more about identity and sexuality in a little bit, but it really is true that it's, as you say, it's core to our identity. It's universal, in fact, because everyone has some sort of relationship with sexuality in one context or another. You know, even someone who's never had sex, I mean, who, you know, has an awareness of sexuality, has an awareness of their own sexuality. And so that's, you know, that's another reason why we wanted to have you on the show, is because it's something that everyone can connect with through their own subjective experiences. But it is so universal. So thanks for sharing that, by the way. And back to sexuality and identity. Why do you think it's a bigger driver of identity for some people versus others? For some people, you know, sex is just one facet of their identity. For others, it's a larger role. Why? Where do you think that comes from, that distinction?
Well, I think there's a few factors to consider. First of all, I think some of it is hereditary. You know, some people have just, we don't know why, we don't know the brain science, but some people have a higher sex drive than others. So if someone has a very high sex drive, they're going to have more of a relationship to sex, where it being important part of their lives, and someone with lower sex drive.
Right, gay, straight, or whatever.
Indeed, yeah. The other thing is, and I talked about this in my book, which is what's called the stages of coming out models, developed by a psychologist in Australia called Vivian Cass. And she identified six stages. And I don't exactly remember what each individual title was, but I'll give you a brief summary of kind of how it progresses. First, there's this sort of like no awareness. Then there's a dawning. Then there is a kind of more of a gradual dawning. Then there is this acceptance. Then there's this real like activism about it, and then it's finally integrated. Okay, so sometimes people are in different parts of that process. Sometimes they are maybe at a stage where they've done so much work in terms of accepting who they are that now it is a point of such identity that and I encourage this, but it's such identity that there's a big activist part to it in terms of maybe they in this stage it's not uncommon to be so identified with that part of who you are that maybe you say, you know, I only associate with that community, and these other people are people who have oppressed me in the past, and I don't know, I'm different from them. And so there's this kind of activist part that maybe is a little maybe unproductive. But at any rate, at the last level, according to this model, there's integration. So let's see how that plays out. So somebody who is gay may kind of, especially before the internet and where we're at right now, but they may have a dawning like, I don't know, this is strange that I look at boys and what is up with this? And then they try to suppress it. And then maybe they meet some other people who are gay, and then they realize there's this word, homosexuality. And then they wonder, is that me? And eventually maybe they get to a stage where they're like, okay, I'm gay. And then they're like, well, damn it, I spent my whole time, you know, covering this up, and I was so ashamed that I'm going to be really out and proud about it, which is wonderful. And maybe then they only really focus on gay-related events.
Right.
But eventually, according to this model, they'll say, you know what, being gay is just one part of who I am.
Right, and that's why I asked the question. I mean, I happen to know gay people who fall into, you know, several of those categories you mentioned, mm-hmm. Some where it's their, you know, the predominant forefront of how they see themselves and their identity, and some who, you know, it's to them, it's just one facet mm-hmm. of who they are.
Mm-hmm.
And straight people as well. You mm-hmm. know, I know heterosexual people who are, you know, very discreet about their sexuality mm-hmm. and others who love to brag and talk about it and go on about it. So I think it's interesting to see how different people, you know, integrate that their sexuality as part of their identity. Because for some people, it's at the forefront. And for other people, it's just part and parcel of the greater individual.
I think there's also other factors. So personality traits. Is this person more extroverted and maybe somewhat exhibitionistic? They're going to want to talk more about who they are. And so that's going to be maybe a focus of what they talk about with their friends. Is this a person who's more open to new experiences? That's just going to make them more vocal. Who is there in their social circle, in their milieu? If they live in a community where this is a discourse that happens very openly, they'll do the same. If they feel like they're like, well, I don't know if this is appropriate to talk about, you won't hear my. So, you know, again, it's there's so many traits. Where is this person in his or her personal growth? What is this person's individual personality traits? What is the social environment in which this person finds him or herself? These are all things that play a role.
And you have to measure all these when you're meeting with a client, mm-hmm. somebody who's, let's say, in the confidence stage or the aggressive stage or the activist stage,
mm-hmm.
and you're holding it back and you're saying, okay, they're at this stage, this is going to change, this is not going to be their sole definer of their identity,
mm-hmm.
they're going to move to that next stage and mm-hmm. and put it in some kind of perspective.
Yeah, you know, I think that's a really good perspective, and I like to see people as very fluid and non-static. You know, people are always somewhere in their journey, and one person may be over here and one person is over there, but they're on their journey. And the only thing I really care about, well, not the only, but one of the most important things I care about is, are they on a journey or are they mired in stuckness where right. there's no growth, there's no
stuckness. I like that.
Yeah, there's no evolving. Is this person literally, and I hate to use this phrase, but are they waiting to die because there's no growth happening? Mm-hmm. So if I see a person who's growing, that's the most important thing rather than where they're at in their journey, because where they're going to end up is, you know, it's like the phrase, it's the journey, not the destination, or something, that some derivative of that.
And sexuality is such a great area to encourage growth. When somebody's having sex, you know that there's an opportunity for them to grow. If, you know, not that if you're not having sex, you can't grow. But when you're interacting with another human being, you know, the challenges and the opportunities to grow and to become different present themselves much more often than for those who aren't having sex.
Why do you think that is?
Well, because you're with another human being and you have to take in their reality. And growth is really one aspect of growth, is really measuring and assessing another person and their personality. And again, activating these five factors. Like, I get a chance to be more open when I'm with another person. I get to challenge my openness when I'm with another person. When I'm by myself, the opportunity isn't there necessarily.
Well, let's talk about some of the factors that researchers found are key ingredients of really good sex when they interviewed people.
Great.
I think our listeners would love to hear about that.
Yeah. And again, it has nothing to do with, as you'll see, with technique or body parts of a certain dimension. It is not physical, actually. So let's talk about them. Being present was a big one. Being authentic with another person and being able to be vulnerable in the moment.
So when you say being present, just tell people what that means. I mean, I'm here. Does that mean I'm present?
Well, good point. And being present is a subjective experience, but when people feel present or feel that the other person is present, what that really means, I think, is that they're, in the case of the other person, they're really being seen. Or the person who is being present is really in the mindset of really being there with eyes wide open and really seeing. Mm. Rather than, so for example, someone who is having sex but fantasizing or thinking about, you know, the meeting tomorrow at work or, you know, thinking about other things or just really focused on the general sensation, let's get it over with, that person isn't going to be fully present.
Not going to have good sex.
No, it's not being present. And the other person, the partner that they're with, is going to experience that.
Sure. They're going to know it, even subconsciously.
Yeah, they're like, where are you? Where are you?
So being present, being vulnerable, being what else?
Being authentic.
Authentic.
Good communication was listed. A really important one, too, was being able to feel like you can surrender.
Yeah.
And that's a really interesting point because oftentimes, and I think this is something that's rarely talked about. We all have heard about authenticity and communication. I mean, that's talked about a lot, but surrender is not. And, you know, if you think about it, oftentimes, and this kind of combines sociology and psychology, we go through life with a certain mask. You know, there's a social mask that we wear. We present ourselves to people in a certain way. That has been talked about in sociology terms. In psychology, it's been called the false self.
Mm-hmm.
And part of that is we try to, and we see a lot of it. So if you look at social media, it is such an intense sort of, it's sort of like social interaction on steroids. You can see so many of these things play out quickly. So what we see is that people try to really control the way
they're seen.
That they were seen. There's a high level of control.
And that's a trap. Ultimately, that's a trap because people end up becoming identified with what they're putting out there and they're really not that in the first place.
That's right. So we live, someone may call someone a controlling person. That's not necessarily, it's a spectrum. There's varying levels of control. But oftentimes, just by the process of living, we go through life in somewhat of a controlled state. Okay, and great sex is about letting go of that, where it's just like whatever happens, happens. Let's go with the flow. I'm not trying to control how you see me. I'm not trying to control what's going to happen. I don't want you to control. It's just let's be a river, you know? And getting to that part, I think, is very difficult for a lot of people.
Especially men. I mean, we had Esther Perel. We did the fun drive, and we had a show on Esther Perel, and she talks about surrender.
Yeah.
As difficult for men in the first place, more than women, but also that it's really bliss. Heaven on earth really is when you surrender. And I like that you're adding this losing control aspect to it. I mean, of course, men are always concerned about their ejaculation coming too soon. And why not be out of control as long as you can? I mean, prolonging the process of sex.
I think
is that part of good sex?
I think, we want to stay away from just big generalities, but I think that there's a lot to be said about turning sex into sort of an experience. So if it's like wham, bam, thank you, ma'am, 30 seconds, 2 minutes, nobody would really say that was an experience. It was just sort of like, by turning into experience, by its sort of nature, there's going to be more of an extended time to it because you're allowing the space for things to happen.
Right.
So not only are you allowing you're setting the stage for interesting, very inclusive, very kind of connective things to happen, but you have more opportunity for all those wonderful endorphins to rush in. And, you know, people who have peak sexual experiences, they do try to oftentimes extend it. And I've heard this term, the bubble, like they're in the bubble. Like I'm just sort of like in the zone, I'm flowing. These are all words I've heard.
Right.
And so there was this psychologist, I'm going to butcher his name. It's a Polish name, Michali Michashvili or something like that. He wrote a book called Flow, and he talked about what are the ingredients that come into flow state. So part of it that there's a challenge, and part of it that there's – but part of it is just we're totally immersed in what's going on.
Right.
And to be really totally immersed, there has to be a component there where you're not going to be totally immersed in a 10-second activity necessarily as much as maybe running a marathon or doing something that really involves much more of yourself.
Yeah.
And that's not going to happen in a very short
time frame. So when you make sex intentional, you intend to go into it and to create an experience for yourself.
Yes.
The chances are you're going to have good sex or better sex.
Well,
I mean, there's always the spontaneous, quick, these kinds of things. They're always available. But I think the experiential, making it an experience for yourself and your partner.
Yeah, and also not being too outcome oriented. Part of what this study found is that even the people who said they had great sex, they said that 15% of the time it wasn't that great. So it just didn't turn out the way they expected. Or sometimes what they thought was going to be great turned into a quickie. And that's okay.
Right.
You don't want to be too focused on outcomes.
Uh-huh.
And sometimes a quickie is very connective because if you hadn't had a chance to have sex in a while, maybe a quickie is just what the doctor ordered.
Right.
But
and who's really great, 99%, 100% of the time anyway, right?
No, it doesn't happen. So even the people who in this study were identified as people with just blissful sex lives said it's not always great, and that's okay. That's just okay.
Right.
Part of that is surrender. It's like, okay, well, I'm going to be open to whatever happens. If it has to be 100% great, that's a pretty controlled way to approach it.
Yeah, you've got OCD there.
Well, I have a slightly different question for you, Dr. Aaron. Since we are running up towards the end of the program, I'm curious what you think about when a sexual relationship begins between two people. Do you think it matters? Do you think there's significance to waiting? Like there's some people who have this 3-date rule, right? If they like someone after 3 dates, they'll sleep with them. There's some people who, say they will wait till marriage. And there's some people who will sleep with someone as soon as they meet them.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that there is do you think that varies person to person? Or do you think, have you seen a difference between couples who waited to have sex versus couples who had sex right away or relatively quickly? Or do you think it doesn't matter? Or do you think it's an individual thing?
I think what it comes down to is sex is sex and relationships are relationships, and there's a lot of overlap. But the point is how quickly you had sex is not – I haven't seen any study that correlated it with how good are you in terms of having a relationship with a person over an extended period of time. And so I think that there are relationships that have been wonderful where maybe they hooked up the first night, and there are terrible relationships where – they waited a long time. I think it has more to do with people's social milieu, their personality traits, their belief systems, rather than is this a person who is really actualized in a way that makes this person a good partner to another human being. These are different things.
That's interesting. I mean, I know someone who just got out of a relationship, and she told me that she actually slept with this person the first time that they went out, and they wound up staying together for a year and a half.
Yeah.
And she told me in retrospect, it was like a year and a half long one night stand, which made me think, is it true that, people, a relationship may benefit from prolonging that? But as what you say makes a lot of sense, that there is some overlap between sex and relationships, but they're not necessarily one is not necessarily a predictor for the other, right?
Well, you know, it's also how people approach things. Some people have a very more casual attitude towards sex. So they're like, okay, I had sex with this person. I like this person. Things happen naturally. You know, I continue to have sex because I like this person. And, oh, by the way, we're also starting to develop deeper feelings for each other that could turn into a relationship. In this particular case with your friend, what happened is that they had sex, but it seems like all of the other ingredients of a relationship never came into being. And it's not necessarily, I don't think, as a result of when they had sex. It's just that nothing else became baked. The only thing that developed was the sex.
Interesting point. You're tuned into 99.5 FM WBAI. This is The Positive Mind. And if you're just tuning in, we've been sitting down discussing sexuality in society and individuals with Dr. Michael Aaron, who's our guest here. He's a clinical sexologist and certified sex therapist, and you may have seen him on CNN, in the New York Times, on the Wall Street Journal. And make sure to check out his book. It's coming out in October, is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
So October, the book is called Modern Sexuality, from publishers Roman and Littlefield. And that's from Dr. Michael Aaron here. I want to thank you again for joining us and for, you know, giving our listeners this incredible information.
My pleasure.
And for those people who want more information, you can find him at drmichaelaaronnyc.com. That's Dr. Michael Aaron, two A's, A-A-R-O-N, NYC.com. So yeah, thanks again.
Got to have him on again.
Yeah,
plenty of things we didn't talk about.
It would be great to have you back in the future. Absolutely. We'd definitely be interested in that. So
thanks a lot, Mike.
Thanks again for everyone at home tuning in. And we'll be back next week, 1 p.m. right here on 99.5 FM WBAI.
Oh,